The other thing I tie back to smart communities is the potential, the possibilities that the tech and the data bring for people to be creative and to have that influence on their own communities, on their own society through that channel. But for that to work, you've got to have that trust. You've got to have some sort of safe space for them to do that in, where they can actually then work with sort of powerful partners, and powerful partners being government agencies or perhaps corporate power in there, to actually, once they've worked out something that can happen, or once they've actually created something, then actually scaling that side of it. Is it, again, removing legal barriers, regulatory barriers, or is it really just actually getting the financial power and the communications power to get the solutions out there?
Hi, Smart Community friends. In this episode of the Smart Community Podcast, I have another great conversation with Callum Cameron. Based in Estonia for the last 15 years, Callum is the CEO of Digital Path, a company that helps to build responsive digital societies with governments, industry, and entrepreneurs. Callum and I last spoke in 2020 in episode 185, an episode so good we replayed it in our summer series back in December of 2021. So Callum is back to give us a full update. We begin by Callum telling us about his background in corporate IT, his passion for helping people to create change through digital transformation and innovation, as well as giving people the tools and resources to do so. And we also discuss some of the citizen-led initiatives that I have seen in Australia helping to create change. We then discuss the societal shifts we have both seen in our communities during the pandemic, and Callum shares with us what a smart community means to him. Before he discusses some of the shifts he has seen in the smart community space since we last spoke in 2020. Callum then tells us about some of the effects the pandemic had on services in Estonia and some of the exciting projects he's been working on. We finish our chat discussing the emerging trends of collaboration and the need for transparency to create trust in our communities. As always, we hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the smart community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play. With smart communities, the future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Callum. How are you today?
Hey, Zoe. Doing really well, thank you.
That is good to hear. I was going to call you Cameron because your name is Callum Cameron, and then I was going to call you Callum Cameron just for fun, but I stuck with Callum, so here we are. I'm really excited to have you back on the podcast because people might remember 18 months ago you were on the pod, but actually we re-released that episode because it was so good in December during our summer series, which is why I wanted to get you back on the pod to see what you've been up to. But let's throw it over to you first and tell us who you are, your background, and what you're passionate about.
Ooh, big question. Background is, obviously, I'm an Australian based here in Estonia for, I guess, 15 years now. Background is corporate IT, mainly banks, energy companies and the likes, part of the gang who saved the world from Y2K way back when.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You know what? Not enough people say that. People just don't recognize what we did there.
I know. Just briefly, because I'm going to interject, but I still want to go back to you. I had a similar conversation with somebody who worked in security and around Y2K, and you know, people are just like, oh, well, nothing happened, so it was fine. He's like, yeah, that's because we were there behind the scenes doing all the things to make sure it doesn't happen. So it's a very thankless job, you know. When you're in security, if everything's just fine and normal, you're doing a great job, whereas it's only when things go bang is when then people recognize how important it is.
It's when you get noticed, right?
It's when you get noticed, which is sad existence. Anyway, back to you.
Yeah, so last 15 years, based here in Estonia, working mainly with, in the technology environment. So is it with startups? Is it with government? Is it with corporates? So technology, digital transformation, and I guess innovation work.
Yeah, cool. What are you passionate about?
Oh, yes. Having lived here in Estonia for a while, I'm more and more passionate about the sun every day. So it's coming into spring, so very excited about seeing the sun out there today. What I'm actually passionate about day to day, though, is helping people create change. And I guess that comes under the title of digital transformation and innovation. And it doesn't matter whether it's with public sector or with private sector or with startups. It's always about individuals and giving them access to resources and networks and so forth to actually build stuff.
Yeah, cool. I like that. I think bringing it back again, like you just said, the way that you might do it might be different in different organizations, but again, it's bringing it back to that individual and how they're going to use that then to create change, which is, you know, really powerful. Yeah, I like that a lot.
Yeah, I think so. And then it goes to, a while back you renamed to communities, smart communities, didn't you, from, what is it, smart cities or something like this?
Smart city, yep.
And it comes down to exactly the same point, doesn't it? It's ultimately about the people in there,
yeah. Yeah, I agree. And that's why I did shift and why I shifted my language. One, because it is about the people, but two, that then the people engage with that word community much more than smart city. And I wanted to, you know, we've obviously got professionals in this space, but we actually want community to tell us what they think and what their pain points are and how they can really get involved. And I was just thinking, like, in that kind of citizen scientist kind of, you know, element, but it's like this, how do they get involved to use the data, to use the technology? And maybe it's not to do anything that we think is like super advanced or amazing, but maybe it's starting their own business, or maybe they can get that job that then unlocks a cycle of unemployment or whatever the case is, because they are building those digital skills and they've got those, and not just digital skills too. How can we use that different ways of thinking to engage in different ways and communicate in different ways and help people unlock those thoughts and ideas that maybe they think is not even possible because it's never been possible before? And that's where I really like the smart community approach, because it's not just about that technology and data. Those things are really important. And I think if we don't spend enough time, energy, thinking about them or bringing the skill sets in that understand those, then we're really missing an opportunity, because we know that they're infiltrated all of our lives. And if the government and other industries and startups and the like aren't involved in using those to the best of their ability as tools, then we do miss out on opportunities. But it is about using those in the right way, not the right way even, but just like the most effective way.
Yeah, couldn't agree more with all of that. It's there's something special, something amazing that happens when you create those capabilities with individuals around the tech side, around the data side. You give them the belief, actually, alongside that they can actually build things. They can do things themselves, or they now have access to the other people, the networks, the resources to make things happen. And all of these ideas start to get unlocked, ideas that just weren't there before because people didn't, as you said, they didn't think they could in there. And then that has a massive effect on the whole community being activated, being responsible for what they're doing, but then creating the businesses, the entrepreneurial environment. But actually, can I ask, and I know you're meant to be asking the questions here, but can I ask you, because this is something really interesting to me, is what's the situation in Australia these days with regards to sort of citizen-led initiative, citizen-led ideas actually bubbling up and actually creating change instead of what used to feel like quite a top-down approach?
Yeah, great question. I think there's amazing pockets of innovation, and I love talking and working with local government because they're really at the coalface with the community. And I think there's a lot of kind of small projects that might not get enough airtime, which is why I'm also really passionate about celebrating what I call sweat the small stuff. So really celebrating those small wins, and whether it is just that the community has, I don't know, started, and it doesn't even have to have anything to do with technology, but something to do, you know, do something differently. I think there still is potentially barriers to that citizen-led approach, with regulation and bringing partners on board and all those type of things as well that could be helped. But I do feel like now that we're coming out of this pandemic, fingers crossed, shouldn't say those things, touch wood, I feel like maybe that there's more hope in the world. I don't really know what else, other way to put it. I feel like the last 2 years, there's been a lot of, I guess, helplessness or hopelessness, probably is the word, hopelessness, which may have then stunted some of this citizen-led approaches. But also, I have seen a lot of, you know, in response to the pandemic, citizens taking on, particularly in the beginning, like making sure their elderly neighbours are safe, have food, can access certain things. And I think that's continued on, which I think is really powerful. And then using technology tools to be able to shift and change and do things. I think community groups have a really special role in the smart community space where they are starting their own initiatives and then are able to then kind of push those levers that are needed to be pushed with the government or industry or whoever it is. So there's definite pockets, and I think there's more and more willingness and enablement to get citizens involved or community involved through engagement, which we had to do in the past, but I think it's now improving. But I think it's going to be more and more. And the more that people are in this space, the more they realize, okay, it's not just about a widget. It's not just about installing some technology. It really is about bringing the community along the journey and really finding out what it is that they want, those pain points. But then also marrying that up with the data. So I think building trust in this space is really important, but also showing the data. So thinking about, well, the community said they really want X. That's the thing that they really want. And then marrying that up with the data to say, well, actually, we looked at the data and actually we're doing this, this, and this. Maybe it's just the information isn't available. Maybe the access isn't there. So I think working together with the community and working together with who understands those mechanisms is really important. So yeah, that hasn't given you a real, you know, short, sharp answer there, which I don't tend to do anyway. But I do think now that we've come out of this next phase, we hopefully will see more, because we're also seeing this shift in, which I think is related, like this shift in people moving jobs, right? So they're calling it the Great Resignation, but actually people are just shifting to this, you know, the next thing or a different thing. And I think we'll see the same with people appreciating what's happening in their local community and then reaching out to their global community to be able to actually put projects in flight and place and really drive that along.
Yeah, it's amazing what happens when you give people a moment to just stop and think for a little bit, yeah? Which I guess is one of the few benefits of the pandemic has been that people have been sort of, at least for a short while, they weren't so busy anymore.
I think a silver lining, I mean, for sure. But I do think then when it was just a short time, we kind of went, oh, yep, that's good, we'll pause. Although I didn't feel like I paused at all, to be perfectly honest.
Actually, to be fair, it all sped up as well, yeah.
Yeah, which is, I mean, a blessing and a curse too. Like the industry that I'm in, we were able to work from home, whereas I think that pause is probably, you know, for others was probably uninvited because they weren't able to work, right, and continue not to be able to. But yes, I agree. I think there was a moment where you were able to, I guess, breathe and go, okay, I'm not doing it the way I've always done it because I physically cannot. So how am I going to shift and change to do that? And I think we'll see more and more of that. Also in the sense of we know what's possible now. We know that things can shift and change if it needs to urgently. Yes, it's not all, it hasn't all been 100% good, bad, whatever your views are on it, but things shifted quite quickly when they needed to. So we can use it as a bit of a learning to go when we really care about something, as in we think it's important that we need to act on it, we can. And I think we can take that same thinking into some of these other big wicked problems if we really want to shift and change those. And also the way we work too has been an interesting one, because a lot of those barriers were like, oh, we can't do it because this is the way, you know, has to be in the office or has to be this. And it really, it can stop progress. Whereas we know that we can push forward now. And yes, there's challenges and things that have happened, as in people work in different ways, but that's always been the case. It's just now we can hopefully have more flexibility to choose that channel or that way of working that works for us too.
Yep, absolutely. A lot of the sort of established norms have been challenged here and has been given an opportunity to go, actually, do we really have to do it that way? And even, I guess, back in 2005, a bank I was working with in London, my partner got an opportunity to work over in Luxembourg. So we moved over to Luxembourg and I asked the bank if I could work remotely from Luxembourg. And I was there, I was doing integrations for their web systems and the likes. And absolutely not. It was just that they'd love to keep me there, but it was just far too risky to do it remotely. And obviously nowadays, you just wouldn't think twice about it. I mean, 2 years ago, absolutely. It still was a difficult conversation. People would get there, but it was a difficult conversation. Now it's, I think the question is more about, do I actually really need to be in the office? And people do want to go into the office as well, because there's still that social aspect of being in the office as well, right? But now people are focused on what the value is there, what the important part is about being there, as opposed to being there because they have to be there.
It's like that intentional nature of it too. Like, I've been delivering projects in New South Wales, and I only managed to get there in March of this year, right? And it just wasn't possible. Whereas, and again, there's no denying that being in a place, particularly when you're, you know, working on a strategy or something, really adds to the, I guess, the understanding and the context and the breadth of it for you when you're in that place. And I don't disvalue that, but I think you just have to work harder, right? You have to work harder to get that from the people that live there, to really draw that out, to really listen to the community. And then, like you said, use those moments when you can that are really intentional. It's not just, oh, I'm going into the office because it's because I do and I work 8 to 5 and I don't talk to anyone and I go home. It's, no, I've got something on after work, or, oh, I've got this meeting with the client and it'd be really great if I could meet them in person or in 3D, I call it. So yeah, there's a lot around that for sure. Now, I haven't even asked you anything about smart communities yet, but this has been great conversation. So let's go to, what is a smart community to you?
What is a smart community to me? So first and foremost, it's community. So I think we've been talking a lot about that part, which is probably the most important part here. So it's community, it's people, and then it's with overlaid with tech and data, particularly data flows, which makes it, or at least has the potential to make it more sustainable, more creative, more fun.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. Short and sharp. I like fun. I think fun is an important one to put in there too. I've been thinking about having more fun lately, and really, like, sometimes we think, oh, we'll do fun later, but actually we need to integrate it into everything we do. And one of my good friends always talks about this too. Even the work that we do, we can always add elements of fun no matter what we're doing. Maybe not every day, maybe not every second, but I think that is a really key part, because, you know, it's life. That's what we want. You know, here we are, we're living it. We're at work so much of our life, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's also, you could even put in some sort of, I'm trying to think of the term here, but some sort of colder measure to it as well. If people are having fun, they tend to come up with better ideas. They tend to create a lot more and so forth. And basically having fun means we give more and we get more out of what we're doing. A big fan of it.
Totally. I think you're right too, because there's an element where, I can't believe we're deconstructing fun here, but I do enjoy it.
It's quite a cold conversation, isn't it?
It's like, yeah, thinking about, like, when you're having fun, you're expressing more, you're, like, there must be things that open up in your brain. I'm sure there's, like, research around it. And to have fun, you have to feel more comfortable in the environment, right? And when you feel more comfortable, you're, like, that trust is built, the sharing is happening, all those types of things, you know, the endorphins are happening, so your brain's working better. So more fun, I think.
Absolutely. And as you said, the trust is key. I guess that's another thing I tie back to smart communities is, again, the potential, the possibilities that the tech and the data bring for people to be creative and to have that, I guess, that influence on their own communities, on their own society through that channel. But for that to work, as you say, you've got to have that trust. You've got to have some sort of safe space for them to do that in, where they can actually then work with sort of powerful partners, and powerful partners being sort of government agencies or perhaps corporate power in there, to actually, once they've worked out something that can happen, or once they've actually, I guess, created something, then actually scaling that side of it. Is it, again, removing legal barriers, regulatory barriers that you mentioned earlier? Or is it really just actually getting the financial power and the communications power to get the solutions out there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's lots of different, I don't want to say barriers again, but yeah, there's lots of different elements, I guess, that can go into that. And I think that scalability component is really a key one, and particularly if we want to see real, tangible, measurable benefits, if we're talking about technology or solutions, that type of thing. Because I think sometimes we may not even realize that friction, how much that friction can stop people coming forward with ideas or things progressing. And when you remove that friction, how easy it is then for people to jump on board. And I think there's so many, yeah, you can't, like, there's so many examples of that and things that we wouldn't even know. But I, you know, thinking about things like filling out forms and doing all these things, and maybe they can access this, that, or the other, which means that then they can unlock that opportunity, and then maybe they could live there, which then they would meet that person that would then unlock that opportunity, and then they have an idea, and et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, anyway, it's something that I think about a lot, that friction, how much a lot of the time processes, for the sake of processes, really add a lot of friction, and that how much angst and things that can limit without us even, and we can't even measure that or know that, because there's all this potential that you can't really measure until you unlock the opportunity and go, oh, wow, that's all happening. I can't believe this is all happening.
That's right. And that friction also, as well as slowing things down now, also it demoralizes people. It just reduces overall energy levels. So why even bother trying something if they're going to have to go through all of it? Actually, there's a company I'm consulting to at the moment who want to build out their new innovation strategy. And they have a very clear innovation. They're a tech company here in Estonia. They've got a very well-defined innovation process already. And it generally starts with the chairman saying, this is what we're going to innovate on now, and this is how we're going to do it. And then it goes through the team. But then the team themselves, who are already at sort of 200% capacity of their sort of working so hard, they're very welcome to come up with their own ideas. It's just if they do come up with an idea, they're then told to find time to try and work it out for themselves. And there's just too much friction in the system for them to actually push it through. So they're just not going to bother. It's just not worth their effort. And that, again, happens at societal level as well, right?
Absolutely. Now, speaking of things that you're working on, let's go to that now. There's a couple of things. So I want to talk about things you're currently working on, some of your exciting, most favorite projects. And then also, maybe we want to start with this. We had you back on in 2020. What shifted and changed since then? Obviously, there's a pandemic, there's a war, there's ongoing uncertainty. But tell us about some of the things that have changed.
Yeah, sure. I guess one of the key things with the pandemic, well, two key things with the pandemic. Firstly, the shock of it. Sorry, I'm getting a bit corny here, but actually brought everybody back to recognition of the significance of community. So as you were saying earlier before we came on the podcast, that a lot of individuals and society have sort of woken up and started taking care of one another again instead of being too busy for that. And then there's been the digital transformation side of things, that that transformation has sped up as a lot of corporations and a lot of governments have recognized there's greater risk in not being transforming than there is in actually going through that transformational process, which obviously has its own challenges and risks along the way. But then what's also come into focus was, well, actually, up until recently, most governments that we spoke with about from Estonia talking about digital transformation were mostly interested in the data interoperability solutions we had, how we created the legal and the control structures around that to protect the data, and then all the services and so forth that we could build on top of that. Since Russia invaded Ukraine, and in Ukraine, Estonia has been very active up until still now, but over the years in working with them on their own digital transformation, a lot more focus has now come on to the resilience of the system. So the resilience to cyber attacks, obviously, but also, and this is something, again, we've been talking about for years from here, but as an Australian, I was always a little, not squeamish, but I didn't want to go so strong on the war aspect of it and the significance of having resilience in the event of a war. Normally talking in a like South Pacific countries or in the Caribbean and so forth, we'd focus on the resilience in the face of sort of catastrophic weather events and the likes. But in Estonia, it's always been a geopolitical thing. And so what happens if Estonia is invaded by Russia is, we always left it unnamed, but by Russia, if Estonia is invaded and loses control of the territory, what happens to the digital state in that scenario? So that's all come into focus now as to how Estonia solved that, I guess going back 7-8 years ago now, with this concept of the data embassies, where Estonia's digital state can effectively be rebooted from a secure data center in Luxembourg. And again, at a corporate level, this is old news. It's purely a technological challenge and not much of a challenge in and of itself, just getting your services and your data spread across data centers, which is sufficiently far apart to make sure they're not impacted by the same weather event, geopolitical event, whatever it is in there. But when it comes to state services and data, this is sovereign data. And most countries have legislation in place saying that data, the data of their citizens and so forth, cannot be held outside the state. And so then it's mainly a legal challenge. I'm not sure if we spoke about this last time or not, but the changes that were made here and the bilateral agreement made with Luxembourg, which sort of hacked the Vienna Convention to allow a few racks in a data center, or actually it's a secure room inside a data center, to be designated as Estonian territory, which means that the data is still sovereign or still under Estonian control, and it's all managed from Estonia. 5 years ago, 6 years ago, people were laughing about why this was important. Nowadays, all of a sudden, those who designed it from here in Estonia are now just doing back-to-back interviews and calls with people wanting to work out how they do that with their own national systems.
Yeah, I was just going to add, like, I think the resilience piece is huge. And, like, obviously that's a very, like, and also the word resilience obviously means so many different things, right? And in this case, in, you know, the technology space, I mean, there's also many different forms of resilience. But like you said, it's crazy until it happens, right? And then you go, oh, thank goodness we did that. And I think that's a lot in this space too. And I think it's also now what I think more and more now, we're going to actually measure our response to disruption. And I think once we are able to do that, and then we are able to see who's doing it better or worse and actually quantify that. And I think we do in a certain way, but I think particularly in Australia, we go, oh, that's just what, that's what it costs. And obviously some things may, you know, not be able to be avoided, but others may be able to be avoided. And I think that's when we're measuring things and monitoring things and using the data in effective ways, we can actually start to have some of those conversations, and not to point blame, but just to continue to do better and improve resilience more and more over time, whatever that kind of looks like, whether it's a natural disaster like you were talking about, or a geopolitical one, or a, you know, cyber attack, or whatever the case is. And then also the fact that what can we do to get back online straight away, or back to not business as usual even, but just, you know, those necessary services, because the amount of, you know, time, money, resources that's lost in that is, I think, something that we, now that we can measure that, I think we can then build that into the full life cycle of whatever we're doing, I think is important, because, yeah, that resilience piece is huge. And I think we need to talk more and more about it in the smart city and smart community space.
And do you know what, if the, as you said before, something that's really significant in this space is trust. It's trust in the data, the services, the availability of everything. So if you don't have that resilience there, then it does actually undermine trust as well, which means that the whole progress just gets slowed down or stopped.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'm interested if you know any of the data yet, but like how Estonia performed, I guess, overall. I'm thinking not necessarily like cases and things, but more just like, you know, the disruption to services, the disruption to access to things. I'm wondering whether, and maybe it's too early to say, but given that everything was already digitally focused, do you feel like there was obviously there's a huge shock in the physical space, but in the digital space, was there less of a shock, do you think?
For here in Estonia, no, there wasn't a big shock from a public services space, just because everything was 99% of the services were already online and weren't just sort of online, but were sort of systemic. I mean, it's just how things were done from here, right? So there weren't big challenges there. I think the challenges were very much in the physical world, in the real world. So for the same thing, people needing to do their shopping, people, or I guess most importantly, ultimately, the deskless workers. So people working in hospitality, in hospitals, the medical environment, logistics and so forth, all of that was significantly disrupted. And then the question was how agile could the companies themselves and the government be in keeping these people working? So one of the solutions that came out was an idea that, for example, I think I might have talked about this last time, because it was a solution that came out of one of the hackathon movements, the idea that staff working in hospitality, for example, who weren't going to be needed for who knows how long. At that point, we just didn't know how long, could keep their contracts with their existing employer, but actually work for another employer who actually needed it at the time. So in particular, again, logistics, supermarkets and so forth, delivery services, these sort of guys, which meant that their employment history didn't get disrupted. They didn't have to go through all of the whatever government processes there were to change jobs and so forth. So little agile things like this made a big difference, I think.
Yeah, again, it's just like removing that friction, right?
Yeah. And just thinking a bit differently, being open to thinking a bit differently.
Yeah. So I do want to go to the future, but first, is there any other projects you want to kind of talk about that you've been working on that are, yeah, I guess working in this space and interesting to you?
There's some fun stuff. So I guess I've got my three streams. One is working with the Estonian government and other governments on their, I know this is it's a sort of a nothing word, but on their innovation strategies and programs and the likes. Then doing the same as a sort of a white label platform for corporates. And then there's the digital government consulting and transformation consulting side of things. So I think the most exciting stuff has been happening with the government side, particularly the Accelerate Estonia project, which is the one where we work with, we basically create a safe space for entrepreneurs and the government to work together and experiment on mad ideas together that if they work, can not only change Estonia and create massive economic returns for Estonia, but actually can have some sort of global impact. So this one here has, I guess, become more exciting just because of the increasing trust that's been built within the government. So more and more we're now seeing projects that they don't have the capacity for, they don't have the risk tolerance for, but love the ideas. They're throwing our way to work with these entrepreneurs, or when I say entrepreneurs, they could be anybody from a late stage startup through to a corporate to, yeah, test out those projects. And then at the same time, we're now seeing the spillover in the private sector with more and more exciting projects coming to us. I guess most of the exciting stuff in that space is coming through on the sustainability side, or what in Europe's been called the green turn side. One project I like to call out, which is I think works well with the smart communities topic, is one where they're decarbonizing construction. And this is through modular building design. So there's a platform where you go on and as a property developer or as a government agency, whoever, you go on there and you actually design your building. The platform itself actually adapts that to using modular components that now factories can mass produce, and everybody's connected through the platform here, right? Factories can then mass produce, and then those modules, particularly these guys have a preference for wood that will last many hundreds of years if done well, meaning that when the building has finished its, I guess it's no longer needed, whatever its purpose was has passed, those modules can be pulled apart and redeployed into new buildings. We don't need to go through that manufacturing process to create new modules. So this is cool. And this is all working very nicely. And the team themselves have got nice projects across Estonia and now probably in helping rebuild in Ukraine as well. And I believe actually I saw something on LinkedIn the other day suggesting there's a partnership in Australia as well. I'm not sure exactly where that is or what's going on there. But what gets me really excited about this, as well as the guy being a fantastic entrepreneur, is you can then hook this into your digital twin of the city or the municipality or whatever, which means that when you go to then redesign or you work to build new buildings, not only can you pull on the sort of standardized modules, but you can also see which modules are becoming available from buildings, other constructions in the city at that time. And so you can become far smarter about the way that you basically build once and use many, many, many times, to paraphrase Bill Gates way back in the day.
I love that.
Like that one, yeah. And then there's other ones where we've got a team who's working out a common taxonomy for governments and private sector to actually measure sustainability. And then once they get that platform in place, then that makes it far easier for their company reporting. So it removes friction. As at least here in Europe, more and more companies are being required to report on their sustainability. It also, with when they're looking for financing from banks, they also have to report on this criteria. So there needs to be a common language between corporates or companies and the government on that side. And then the hope is that a lot more FDI and export opportunities will come from Estonia, having removed that friction and that confusion from the space. People can start building from here faster. So yeah, lots of fun stuff going on.
Yeah, sounds like so much fun stuff going on. And I think really thinking, linking smart communities in with these other big, wicked challenge problems, themes that we need to focus on, like sustainability, all those type of things, you know, that circular economy element, that's the way it needs to be, right? It's not we put all our smart things over in this bucket, it's actually bringing it all together. And I think that's really, really important. And then again, removing that friction element to be able to use recycled materials, for example, and then you know, remove that, standardize those elements so then it's easy to be able to do that, I think is really important. And yeah, I guess a running theme of this podcast, unintentionally, but there you go, there it is. I think let's move to the future now. Tell us about the emerging trends that you think people aren't talking about enough.
Ooh, I guess it still goes back to collaboration, that more and more we're seeing that governments and companies recognize that they can move faster, both from a removing friction in society and creating services for society, but also in creating new revenue streams by collaborating with smaller partners. So finding ways that they can experiment with new ideas, either from citizens or from smaller companies, and implement those. But actually trusting the citizens and the smaller companies to implement them for them as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's really important. I think, you know, there's a lot like innovation. It gets thrown around a lot as this like, you know, kind of term, and collaboration similarly. But when it's done well, both, like when they're actually done well and in a genuine kind of sense, that's what really unlocks a lot of these other opportunities. And you also recognize without it, then things don't happen, right? And we can't move forward and we get stuck. But sometimes you don't realize that that's the missing link until you're like, oh my God, oh, we just need this, you know. And again, it takes a bit of a different mindset, a bit of a different way to think about it, really.
Yeah, it does. But once or as soon as people see one or two examples of it working, again, the eyes light up and they start to see all the potential, all of the opportunities here. And then it's the challenge is keeping them focused on their core business as well as doing this other stuff instead of forgetting about the core business and running off in this different direction, right? The other thing I'd probably call out that's come to light, at least for me quite recently, is we've and this is, I guess, a little deeper or on the darker side. Another thing about smart communities, it all comes back to the data, as we spoke about last time, and the how that can be abused, particularly through disinformation. And of course, the point of disinformation is not necessarily to get people to believe something different. It's just to remove the possibility for them to believe in anything, or it's removing that trust from the societal level, which is why previously Russia was able to, so if we go back to Russia's invasion of Crimea and the east of Ukraine in 2014, Russia was able to create enough uncertainty to give particularly leaders around Europe but elsewhere sort of plausible deniability, saying, oh, yeah, we're not really quite sure what's actually happening over there, so we can be careful. What was really interesting and I guess exciting this time around is that the way that was countered actually in the build-up to the actual invasion of the large-scale invasion of Ukraine this time was that I think the US, UK, obviously Ukraine, were very open in sharing their intelligence publicly to say, okay, this is what's going to happen next, this is what's going to happen next, this is what we're expecting and so forth out there, which meant that when a false flag event was created by Russia, then it was already expected. And it was very difficult for the sort of the leaders in Europe to say, oh, we weren't sure. We didn't really know what was going to happen, or maybe it's what the Russians are saying. Maybe there is a reason for this out there. And we knew always that it was crap, and they know it's crap. but it was some sort of ability to hide behind that. But this works. And I think actually constantly, reliably pushing out the truth, pushing out the real facts, actually has seemed to have worked really, really well in this instance. And I guess that for me is one of the learnings, that the autocracy is this sort of insidious creep of disinformation or creating uncertainty in society and then taking advantage of that. And I think the message there is, now that we can see what does work and actually pushing out the facts, pushing out the truth, it just means we have to double down in supporting free press, independent press, and also just showing no tolerance for politicians who lie.
Mm. Yes, I think it's very relevant at the moment, and then even during the pandemic as well, just this layer of truth and facts and trust, and what we can see how dangerous it can be when we don't have that, right? And when we build, when we can't build that. And again, like you said, it's like not necessarily getting them to believe it, but to not believe anything. And then got a disengaged community. And, you know, without just staying in the dark, lifting out of the darkness, it's very similar to, yeah, when you just have a disengaged community for a project or whatever the case is, and you don't build that, you know, the same thing happens at, you know, at a smaller scale, but can stop a project in its tracks, which might be quite good for some, but it's just, yeah, you can't kind of get through that drudgery, which I think we're going to, yeah, it's going to be a challenge of this next little while. Everyone's got a podcast. Everyone's got their own platform. Everyone's got a YouTube channel. Everyone knows everything. Everyone can get a doctor to interview somebody, whatever the case is. So I think, yeah, it's going to be an interesting time moving forward of filtering out the truth so then we can actually make better and real decisions based on informed, or based on being informed, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So we need to double down on the transparency, because that creates trust, that transparency, but also, as you say, educating and motivating people to investigate stuff themselves.
Mm-hmm. This has been such a great conversation, Callum. Thanks so much for coming onto the podcast again. I feel like, again, we could talk for a very long time, but, you know, we better wrap it up there. And it's Friday afternoon here. It's 5 p.m.
Oh, crikey. Wine time.
It's wine time, but I definitely could have another hour conversation or so. So we'll have to have another chat for sure. And I hope one day I get to travel to Estonia.
Well, you were nearly here, weren't you? You were nearly here a couple of years.
Yes, that's right. Anyway, we'll make it happen. We're putting it out into the universe right now that we will that will happen. And I'm sure you'll have to come back to Oz at some point too. But yeah, thanks so much for coming onto the podcast. I really just have one last question, which is, how can people connect with you?
I guess the easiest way is just LinkedIn. LinkedIn or my email address. I'm pretty old school with that. I don't do TikTok and stuff just yet.
Oh, really? Me either.
Yeah, I know. Way behind.
No, me either.
I think the problem is I can't dance.
Yeah, I think I can. My friends film me and show me, and then I still think I can. But, yeah, I don't think anyone else would appreciate it. Well, Caleb, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. Thanks again, and we'll talk real soon.
Will do, for sure. Thanks very much, Zoe.
Bye.
The Smart Community Podcast is brought to you by My Smart Community. If you're looking for support in podcast strategy and production, workshop design and facilitation, or communication and media advisory, get in touch. Email hello@mysmart.community or head to www.mysmart.community.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community/podcast. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community. You can also find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter @smartcomhq. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And we would love for you to leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen.
This really helps us reach more ears and eyes, so thank you for your support. As always, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.